And welcome back to the program. I'm Michael Cohen with producer Desi Simmons. The rich get richer and the poor, well, they're still poor. That seems to be the trend in America. Some studies finding that income inequality in the United States is at an all-time high, surpassing even levels seen during the Great Depression. To discuss how we ended up in this situation, I'm joined by Dean Baker, the author of the new book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Dean is also the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and he earned his PhD in economics from the University of Michigan. Welcome to the program, Dean.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, the first chapter of your book is titled Upward Distribution of Income. It didn't just happen. You say that economic conservatives are largely in control of our politics and in turn dictate our country's economic policies. Although, hasn't that been the case since the birth of our country, and isn't it universally true in countries around the world?
Well, you have economic elites that have obviously enormous power and disproportionate say in politics, but you do have countervailing forces, and that's true in the U.S. and true in other places. The problem is that the countervailing forces have been much weaker lately. Most obviously, I'm thinking of unions, and if you look at the union movement in the United States, currently you have just around 12% of the the workforce that's unionized, the private sector about just 7%. That had been over 20% if you go back to the 70s and close to 30% if you go back to the late 40s, early 50s. Unions are much stronger elsewhere in the world. So if you look at West Europe, you have many countries that have unionization rates of 40 or 50%. The Scandinavian countries, 70, 80%. So there are countervailing pressures. I'm mentioning unions as the most obvious ones, but there are others. And unfortunately, at this point, it's just the countervailing forces have become incredibly weak.
Before we get to some of the other issues, let's focus on unions for just a moment. You know, here in Michigan, the unions are on the ropes, with concessions now being an annual process. That's both state unions, public unions. Do you think that unions may face extinction at some point in the coming decades?
Well, I sure hope not. I mean, unions, when I envision, you know, whatever hopes I might have for sort of a rebirth of progressive politics, I think unions are part of the story. They aren't going to be the whole story. I mean, I don't envision that we're going to get whatever progressive politics we see in the 21st century be the exact image of what we had in the last century, in the 20th century. But they continue, even now, even in their weakened state, to be a tremendously important actor in every progressive cause I could think of. And, you know, insofar as we think of things, you know, just a wide range of issues, not even things directly related to the workplace, things like voting rights. I mean, unions are there. They're hugely important. Civil rights, of course, unions, you know, for not just African-Americans, women, gay, lesbian rights, I mean, on down the list, they continue to be hugely important, just about every progressive movement you could think of. So a world without unions would be a scary story, but I don't think that, you know, at the end of the day, if we think that, say, 10, 15, 20 years out, we have a revitalized union movement, progressive movement, is going to be as dominated by the labor movement as was true, say, in the 30s and 40s and 50s, where obviously the labor movement was very much at the core of the Democratic Party and everything that was going on that was progressive in the country.
Now, your book points out a key problem when it comes to the current structure of economic debate. You write, quote, the debate, the way it's structured now, creates a scenario in which progressives are portrayed as wanting to tax the winners in society in order to reward the losers. The right gets to be portrayed as the champions of hard work and innovation, while progressives are seen as the champions of the slothful and incompetent. If progressives want to turn things around, how should they frame the economic debate we're now facing?
Well, one of my main points is that we have to focus on before-tax distribution of income. So there's been this idea that, okay, we have the market that determines income distribution, and then we see that some people get very wealthy and a lot of people end up very poor with very little. So we want to take from the wealthy and help out those who are poor or didn't get very much. Well, that may be true, that we don't want to see, you know, some people very wealthy and a lot of people with very little. But the point I'm emphasizing in the book is it didn't just turn out that way. The right rigged the rules. And what I'm saying is we have to go back and change the rules, unrig the rules, so that they don't have income flowing upward. And I go through a number of issues. Trade policy is, you know, very important. Part of that story is the dollar. An overvalued dollar makes it very difficult for U.S. goods to compete internationally. So our cars have a very difficult time competing, our auto workers, I should say, when we're looking at competing with workers who might get paid a tenth as much in Mexico or China or other countries. It's just very, you know, that's straight economics, by the way. This is not, you know, some sort of left-wing economics. This is what the standard economics says. The Federal Reserve Board is something most people don't pay a lot of attention to. It's hugely important. The Federal Reserve Board could prevent and has often and other at times prevented people from getting jobs. It could be more aggressive today and make it easier for people to get jobs.
The debt ceiling debate seemed to be the initial step to the ultimate discussion that many economists say will involve reductions to the Medicare and Social Security systems. Do you think these programs, as many predict, will overwhelm our economy as they're currently structured?
No, and what's really striking is a lot of dishonesty in the policy debates on this, because there's a fundamentally different story behind Medicare and Social Security. We are aging as a country, and we have been aging always. I mean, that's most of us think it's a good thing, you know, because of improvements in living standards and medicine, people are living longer. And that's not something that just happened. You know, we have a higher percentage of the population retired today than was true 50 years ago. And 50 years from now, it'll be even higher. And in principle, that's not a big problem. We don't have deteriorating living standards today relative to 1960 because we have, you know, just three workers for every retiree as opposed to five back then. I mean, that's no. I've never heard anyone say that's why, you know, living standards aren't higher. It'd be ridiculous. We could deal with the impact of the aging of the population. What we can't deal with is the fact that we have a broken healthcare system. We already spend about twice as much per person as the average for other wealthy countries, you know, Germany, Canada, whoever you want to throw into that mix. And that gap's projected to keep growing over the next two, three, four decades. If that's true, then Medicare becomes absolutely unsustainable, but that's because our healthcare system's broken. And what I think any honest person would say about this is, well, that just shows the urgency of fixing our healthcare system. And, you know, that was in principle what our debate on healthcare reform was about last year, you know, that we were going to try to get healthcare costs down, both extend coverage, but find ways of controlling costs. Now, the extent to which we did that, you know, that's still up in the air. We don't know what the program will look like. There's a lot of debate on that.
I'm talking to Dean Baker. He's the author of the new book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. He's also the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You know, here in Michigan, we're seeing a dramatic change. We're seeing the elimination of the Michigan business tax. Now politicians are talking about removing the personal property tax from businesses. And the term you hear when it comes to these kinds of bills is job creators, and that if we burden those that are financially able to create jobs, we're only going to end up with less of them. Isn't that a reasonable argument?
Well, there may be some very, very marginal impact, but the reality is that very few businesses are going to be investing because of tax cuts. And a lot of business people, when they're being honest, will say that. I remember Paul O'Neill, who was the Treasury Secretary under President Bush. He was testifying before Congress, and he was asked about tax cuts. He goes, you know, look, I've run many businesses. He'd been the head of Alcoa Aluminum, International Paper, and probably one or two others. He said, I've never been a business person who invests because of tax cuts. He goes, we're happy to get them, but that's not why we invest. And I think the basic story is that, you know, if Michigan and other states get into this situation where, you know, the businesses come whining to them and say, oh, we need tax cuts, well, they give away revenue, and then they either have to go without services, you know, you're going to cut back your education, cut back your infrastructure, which is going to hurt business, or you turn around and you tax the ordinary workers who, you know, really need that money. So I think that's just a losing path. I mean, obviously you can have taxes that are so high that they really do drive business out, but I don't think that's true in Michigan. I don't think in general that's the situation we're talking about in this country.
I want to ask you a final kind of a broad question, because when I think of economic conservatives, they view the world in a way where they see the nature of most humans is that they spend what they have. And being frugal and conservative is a relatively rare quality. Doesn't that, when you look at the big picture of how things are structured, explain why many people end up in a financial bind, even after years of earning a considerable income, and why we see the structure of the economy that we do now?
Well, you see a lot of people that end up being harmed by factors that in many ways were beyond their control. I mean, you could say, you know, people should have had better foresight, but I know a lot of people in my profession, you know, economists who didn't have any better foresight than, you know, your average auto worker or whatever. So, I mean, you could say, well, you should have known that the auto industry was vulnerable and you should have, you know, prepared for a different career, you know, someone in their 40s, you know, rather than stuck being laid off from one of the big three. You should realize that your house price could plummet because, you know, if the auto industry goes down in Michigan, house price, I mean, you can say all that, but, you know, that's really expecting a lot of people. And I think as a practical matter, the fact is most people do what they can. They act reasonably given the circumstances. And I blame much more the people who are designing the policy. It wasn't individuals acting stupidly in the sense of buying homes that got us here. It was, you know, you had Alan Greenspan at the Federal Reserve Board who was sitting there with the levers of the economy in his hands, and he just let the housing bubble keep growing, grow, and grow. So we could always say, you know, any individual could have made better decisions, and that's true, no doubt about it. But the fact is, the reason most people are in trouble today are in trouble is because the people controlling economic policy really messed up in a big way.
What about the American dream, the one that says that anyone can make it as long as they're ready to work hard and be persistent? Do you believe that to still be the truth here in the U.S.?
Well, you have a lot of people that worked hard, were persistent, and, you know, ended up in really bad shape. So that doesn't mean people didn't work hard, were persistent, and did make it. But there's a lot of people that did the exact same thing and had some bad luck. So there's no guarantees in this story. So, you know, obviously you're going to do better if you work hard than you don't, but that doesn't guarantee you that you're going to end up okay.
Dean Baker, the author of the new book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, also the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And we'll be right back with more. I'm Michael Cohen. You're listening to 1320 WILS.